This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Scott Kirshner. Let's take a look at General Electric, the huge conglomerate that traces its roots back to Thomas Edison in the 1890s. More recently, you may have seen this GE spot on TV where a young software developer comes home and announces he's landed a job with GE.
Proud of you, son. GE, manufacturer.
Well, that's why I dug this out for you.
It's your grandpappy's hammer, and he would have wanted you to have it.
It meant a lot to him.
Yes, GE makes powerful machines, but I'll be writing the code that will allow those machines to share information with each other.
So grandpappy's hammer isn't going to help the software developer with his new job.
But moving GE's headquarters to Boston might do a lot of good for young Owen in that ad. GE is currently based in Fairfield, Connecticut, but the company is hunting for a new home, both for tax reasons and because it wants to get better connected to, quote, an ecosystem that is forward-looking and future-looking, in the words of Chief Executive Jeffrey Immelt. Two finalists for the corporate HQ beauty pageant now, New York and Boston, Manhattan or Westchester County versus the Seaport Innovation District.
So what are odds in this latest Boston versus New York showdown? Joining us for some handicapping is former Massachusetts Secretary of Housing and Economic Development Greg Bialecki. He's now Executive Vice President of Redgate, a real estate investment firm. Greg, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks, Scott.
So, Greg, give us your take on this. Like, take us inside these negotiations and how the state gets involved.
Well, for most big companies, certainly one like GE, this is such a significant move. They know there are a lot of suitors for the opportunity, so they are not going to be shy. They're going to be contacting a governor and a mayor and saying, we're thinking about you. Tell us what you could do to help make the decision in your favor. So we don't really have to chase the opportunity. They come to us. You know, many people might think that the conversation immediately turns to business incentives, what kind of tax breaks can get offered. But we found really that you want to look at the whole spectrum of opportunity. You want to understand what can we offer across the board that would make this a great home for GE or someone else. It could be great software town, a lot of great young coders. It could be proximity to university research. Obviously, in the life sciences, that proximity to universities and hospitals has been so key. And also, you want to size up who your competition is, right? That what can we say that we have a distinctive advantage, and what can we learn about the company about what else opportunities they're considering?
So if GE's looking at, you know, I think they were looking at Atlanta at one point. Mm-hmm. They were considering Rhode Island. They're still considering, reports say, New York and Westchester County. What do Boston and what does Massachusetts say to position ourselves against those regions?
So we have a great claim. You know, we would love to say that we are continue to be the innovation hub of the country, but obviously a lot of exciting stuff happening in Silicon Valley. So that is a tough competition, but I think we have a great claim that we're the innovation capital of the East Coast of the United States, particularly everything that's happened here over the last 10 years, not only in the life sciences, but the strength of our startup community and the growth of some of our great small tech companies into some pretty sizable big tech companies, iRobot, for example. So certainly when it's an advantage, huge advantage for us, I think the GE clearly signaled that they were looking for the East Coast of the United States. We know also their company, as we've all heard those ads, is interesting in repositioning itself as a 21st century innovation company. So certainly Massachusetts and Boston starts by playing the card. If you want to be on the East Coast, you want to be on the innovation capital of the East Coast, Boston.
But what about the tax question, though? I mean, it is a big part. It may not be the entire calculus, but, I mean, is Massachusetts competitive on the corporate tax front?
We're more competitive than people give us credit for, and that reputation. I'm here again today to say Taxachusetts is a slogan from the past. But I think what's really interesting, if you look at the story about Connecticut, a lot of GE's complaints were the lack of predictability about taxes, that Connecticut was facing some severe budget challenges, and that meant that GE couldn't be assured of what the tax climate was going to look like for a big company like that over the next 10 years or so. Massachusetts, whether you want to argue our taxes are too high or not, we've been pretty predictable in our taxes. If you look at most corporate business surveys, where we stand in tax rate, business tax rate, has been, we've been pretty much in the same spot compared to other states for 10 or 20 years now, whether we've had a Republican or Democratic governor. So, yeah, the GE is going to calculate the corporate tax rate here, the income tax their executives will pay, but they can have a lot more confidence. We've got balance. We always have budget challenges, but they're pretty balanced. We've got a great bond rating in this state. I don't think anybody's suggesting that we're going to raise taxes dramatically in the next few years. So there's a lot of predictability.
How about just the logistics? I mean, when I think about Westchester County, a lot of these executives, I think we're talking about 800 executives right. or so. A lot of them could potentially stay in their homes in western Connecticut,
and work
the New York suburbs,
yeah.
and work just across the border versus like getting all those people to move and buy houses in Boston. How do they think through that calculus?
Yeah, that's one. I think that's the big wild card in the discussion. You predicted this morning that Boston was going to win on the strength of our innovation reputation. I think that's I think you're probably right. I think that in the end, that is a huge advantage for us, both in the reality, get all that young talent here to be around these young startups in healthcare, in energy, the areas GE is focusing on, robotics and Internet of Things, where we're so strong. But if you said, what are you concerned about, you've put your finger on it. You've got a lot of people who are probably very happy in their homes. They probably have kids in school, and that's a big disruption. The other thing to keep in mind in that regard is that even if the announcement happens today, this afternoon, it's a process. They are going to move up here. Presumably, they're going to want a new building for their headquarters. And so what we're talking about is a move that would actually unfold over the next 3 to 5 years, I'm going to guess, which means that you don't have to worry as much about the executives, what they're doing right now. They have time to plan and change their lives.
Well, so what about the Innovation District itself? I mean, obviously, it's undergone a huge amount of change, right, Scott? But also, I feel like we're starting to feel the limits of what can be done there. I mean, we were just discussing this morning how
traffic can be a pain.
It's tough to
get in
and out.
No one likes the silver line.
I mean, imagine some of these executives might helicopter in, but the rest of them would still have to deal with the T or walking or whatever. I mean,
yeah. So it's a fascinating thing for this company and for other companies. We're seeing the same thing on the West Coast. Those tech companies that are coming up out of the Valley into San Francisco, right? So there's no question, I think, here on the East Coast and the West Coast, that a lot of big companies are saying, we have to be in the middle of cities. That's how we get the talent. That's how we rub elbows with the startups that we want to be associated with. The corollary to that is, if you're in the middle of a city, there's a lot of daily grind issues.
Yeah, it's cheek by jowl. It's not just elbows, right?
That you're not facing when you have your nice suburban campus. And so that's something, there's going to be a little culture shock around that. But I think if you find not just a GE decision, because I think practically they're going to wind up in the middle of a more urban environment either way, but not just GE, but other companies, I think there's the trend in the United States, clearly, even for big companies, is we're going to put up with the traffic, we're going to put up with the noise, we're going to put up with the pushing and shoving. We got to be in the middle of the action. We got to be in a big city.
Do you think, Greg, that there's any chance they stay in Connecticut and this whole search is basically just about having leverage in their negotiations with the governor and the state officials there?
There is always a chance of that. And in fact, in my old job, we used to start the conversation with the assumption that we were probably a stalking horse, actually. Uh-huh. And for the reasons we mentioned, it's just so easy. If you have an existing facility that works for you, you've got all those people you have to relocate. There's a lot of inconvenience with moving, picking up stakes and moving. And it's, you know, pretty clever corporate strategy to say, well, if why don't I get some bids from other people and bring them back to my hometown and see how I can do? So we always used to start with that assumption. I think in this case, that a variety of factors, if it were just one thing, I might feel differently. But in this case, you have both the desire of GE to reposition themselves. And I think a big suburban campus, Fairfield County, isn't a great spot for them to do it. And then you add to that not just the tax promises that can be made today, but where is Connecticut going to be over the next few years? And I think those combination of factors lead me to think that they're serious now.
So Greg, I just want to throw in one more question about this. Let me play the role of the Massachusetts optimist.
Yes.
And just say this does happen. I mean, how big would it be for Massachusetts, for Boston?
I think it's enormous for us, really, because we have done a great job of starting young companies, and we've done a pretty good job of having those small companies grow big. We've got some nice examples of that in life sciences and in tech now. But if you're really, really on top of your game, you're not only growing great firms locally, but you're so hot, people want to come and be near you. And that's what we got to that level of sort of white hot level in life sciences, right? Not only did we grow some great small companies, but basically all of the major European pharmaceutical companies said, we have got to be in Boston or Cambridge. We've just got to be here. So for GE to say, we just thought it was so important to be close to the innovation on the tech side in the areas that they're strong in, that we just had to be in Boston, I think is another level of success for us.
We're talking about GE's headquarters possibly moving to Boston with Greg Bialecki, former Secretary of Housing and Economic Development in Massachusetts, now a vice president of Redgate, a real estate investment firm in Boston. Greg, so I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the Mass Competitive Partnership, a powerful business organization made up of 15 CEOs from top companies in Massachusetts. And my understanding is this Mass Competitive Partnership has been involved in helping Governor Charlie Baker try to woo GE. Is that your sense too?
Yes, absolutely. They have been involved in, I think, both in giving peer-to-peer advice and explaining to the folks at GE what the business climate is like and what opportunities are, but also in helping the governor and his administration put on the strongest case.
Let's bring in now David Luberoff, Senior Project Advisor for the Boston Area Research Initiative at Harvard University, and talk a little more about this Massachusetts Competitive Partnership. Hi, David.
Hi.
So,
hi, Greg.
Hi, David.
So there was a similar organization to the Mass Competitive Partnership that started in 1959 that came to be known as the Vault and had held a lot of influence over the city's policy. David, tell us a little bit about the Vault.
So the Vault was, as you said, a business-led group similar to business-led coalitions that showed up in a bunch of American cities in the first two decades after World War II, primarily concerned with the problem then of urban decline, people and jobs leaving the city, and in the case of Boston, leaving the region. It was somewhat different than the Competitive Partnership, one, because it was very focused on Boston, two, because it was really led by the financial institutions, and at the time, Boston had about a dozen major commercial banks whose fate was very much tied to Massachusetts under banking regulation at the time. They were Massachusetts banks, and they held a fair amount of the city's debt and were actually quite worried that the city might go bankrupt. In fact, the name, the Coordinating Committee, its official name was originally to coordinate those bankruptcy proceedings.
And my understanding, I love this fact, that is they met in a former bank vault in downtown Crossing.
I believe it was the Boston 5 and 10 cent savings bank's vault had been converted to sort of their executive dining room. So they met. Now, the similarity is that it too was a CEO-only organization. So you had people at the highest level of the firms who could really make commitments and speak for their companies. In I think, a very important way. I'm sure Greg would agree with that. And in its heyday, probably had about 25, 30 members, mainly the banks, the then dominant downtown retailers, Filene's and Jordan Marsh, that some of us still
remember. I remember them well.
Yeah, the utility companies, New England Telephone. What's really remarkable, if you look back at the Vault roster, even as late as the early 80s, which was its kind of last of its influential time, about two-thirds of the companies that were part of the Vault no longer exist.
And so is that why the original Vault went away, because the companies went away?
I think it's two parts. One is, I think it's three parts. One is, with deregulation of things like banking and utilities, the local firms got bought up and didn't have as much of a local focus. The second piece is due to a quirk in the way tax laws changed in the 1980s, banks were no longer rewarded for holding tax-exempt local debt. They were actually penalized for it. So all the banks shed their debt and had much less incentive to worry about the city of Boston's finances. And the third was a general political pushback against a sort of top-down corporate power. And the whole, if you think about Boston, you know, starting in the late 60s through the 70s, the rise of essentially neighborhood-based resistance, almost rebellion, both to urban freeways and to urban renewal projects. And the vault was associated very strongly with both of those. So I think a lot less tolerance of this kind of a dominant backroom group.
Well, so, I mean, do you see this new iteration, the Mass Competitive Partnership, being much different? I mean, it's formed by John Fish from Suffolk Construction, Chad Gifford, the former CEO of Bank of America, the former CEO of Raytheon. That sounds pretty top down to me.
It in that sense, it's similar. And I think, and again, I'd love to hear Greg's thoughts on this, the ability to put the state's largest employers in a room and have them express their concerns, that is part of the legitimate public policy process. I mean, the Competitive Partnership does not strike me as a group that tries to dictate the agenda, and it's not entirely clear the extent to which the vault really dictated the agenda, but it is a venue where, you know, important businesses can express their concerns and also provides, probably facilitates a way for key government officials to talk with business leaders about what they're trying to accomplish, as Greg was saying.
Greg,
you know,
do you want to recruit GE? Do you want to jump in there, Greg?
Yeah, well, listen, I agree with David's history. I think it's very interesting. As you say, Scott, certainly that's an important group of 15 people sitting around a table. But I think in some ways, David talked about how there was a backlash against top-down control. And in some ways, these senior executives of our biggest companies were saying, well, wait a moment, okay, here's the backlash to the backlash, which is we are important. Our companies are important. They employ thousands of people. The goods and services we buy locally are probably hundreds of millions of dollars. And we'll still go to the Chamber of Commerce events where there's hundreds or thousands of members. But we'd like an opportunity to tell you directly what we think and not just be one voter among a thousand chamber members. So they have, and I think it's very different, and David keyed on this. I don't think they're trying to dictate an agenda. They've intentionally chosen some topics that they feel very strongly about. We worked with them on one is trying to improve community college education to make folks who come out of community college more ready for careers.
But they also apparently lobbied against Cape Wind, the wind farm on Nantucket Sound, right? Lobbied against the Mass Green Communities Act.
They did. They have certainly energy costs, and they have a distinctive view on renewable energy and the effect of Massachusetts energy costs, and that's been a part of their agenda. But even then, they're doing their, you know, they are advocating with the legislature and elected officials, and I don't think that anybody could say that they feel that when they sit in that room, they're able to dictate an agenda for the state.
Except the Globe did report that Boston 2024 had parts of its origins in this group. And speaking of Boston still resisting top-down you know, assertions of policy and programs, I mean, isn't that people's exhibit A right now?
Well, I think that so that's an interesting little case because I think, in fact, what happened is the interest in Boston 2024, I think, began to be discussed around that table. But if you see what happened, it really was several of the members of the group decided to pursue it. It was not really a group official group activity.
And there was some concern about it within the group.
Yeah, there was a discussion. And that group, from everything I saw, for the things that it pursues itself, was really based on consensus. Is this something the whole group can get around? And when they talked around the table and saw that different members had different feelings about the Olympics, they said, those of you who are passionate about it, go for it, but it's not going to be a group activity.
We should maybe mention before David jumps in, we asked the Mass Competitive Partnership to send us a spokesperson on the show, and they declined. David, I wanted to just observe, so this is a group of 15 CEOs, 14 of them are men. There's one female member, Abigail Johnson, the CEO of Fidelity Investments. What does that say about Boston? I mean, is that an issue, you know, when you're talking about people representing Boston business in the 21st century?
Well, I think that that's a function of the fact that by its structure, as I understand it, the group is a CEO's only entity. And there's an important power when groups, and this is not unusual, when groups say, you know, either the CEO comes or you're not at the table, that makes a very important statement. And the simple fact of the matter is that for all of the growing diversity of Greater Boston, the CEOs of particularly our most major companies are still largely white men. So I think it reflects a reality of the corporate world, and obviously a tactical decision that to maximize their effectiveness as a voice of the firms, that they wanted to stay with CEOs. It's an interesting tactical question. The optics, of course, are not great.
Thank you. David Lubaroff is the senior project advisor for the Boston Area Research Initiative at Harvard University, visiting professor at Northeastern. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
And Greg Bialecki is executive vice president of the real estate investment firm Redgate and former Massachusetts Housing and Economic Development Secretary. Thanks, Greg.
Thank you both.
Well, before we wrap up, I just want to put a call out there to listeners. We were talking about GE earlier, maybe coming to Boston. Send us a tweet at Radio Boston if you think that might actually happen. Again, we're at Radio Boston. We'll be back in just a minute. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Scott Kersner. This is Radio Boston.